This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck. Vermont anglers are chomping at the bit this week. Trout and landlocked salmon fishing season opens Saturday, as does catch and release bass season. So we figured now would be a good time to discuss gear, hear from experts about where to fish, how well our waters are stocked, and talk about how the state's fish have rebounded from Tropical Storm Irene. Vermont Fish and Wildlife Commissioner Patrick Berry is in our Montpelier studio. Lawrence Pine, outdoor writer for the Burlington Free Press and host of Vermont Public Television's Outdoor Journal, is here with me in Colchester. Gentlemen, great to have you on the program today.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
So, on opening day last year, VPR's John Dillon met up with trout fishers on the Willoughby River in Orleans. One was Bridget Riley, who's an accomplished lake angler and has won a couple of ice fishing tournaments. But on opening day last year, she was up at dawn to cast for rainbows.
There's something about standing on the river that's just so healing or so relaxing. I mean, I love boats. I love the sunshine and the warmth, but there's something about river fishing that is like no other.
I got one down there.
She sounds like my husband. He loves to go fly fishing and just savor the quiet of the river and time alone outside. Listeners, what do you like about fishing? Do you prefer flies, lures, or worms? Do you go out with your buddies or head to your favorite stream all alone? We welcome your calls today at 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a comment at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Trout fishing in particular seems to have an almost poetic cachet around it, and I'm thinking of several books we have at home. A River Runs Through It may be the best known, but I also came across a book called Halcyon Days by Bryn Hammond, and I liked what it said on the inside cover. It said, "It's been said that a fly rod is almost a magic wand that transports us to some of nature's loveliest places," which may help explain why more books have been written about trout fishing than any other subject, outdoor subject. Pat Berry, what is it about trout fishing that seems to capture the imagination?
Well, I think that the gal that John Dillon interviewed last year, and I was lucky enough, I was there with him up at dawn out on the Willoughby too, pretty much hit it on the head. Trout fishing takes you to some of the most beautiful natural environments on the planet. And trout themselves are often considered the canary in the coal mine for water quality. They live in cold, clear streams most of the time. And, you know, there's not just those beautiful places they take you, but the opening day of trout fishing season for a lot of people is the best cure for cabin fever, especially because we've got some interesting weather the next day or so. Saturday is supposed to be a nice day. I think it's a combination of factors in Vermont in particular that make it so incredibly appealing. And lastly, I'd add, you know, there's obviously fly fishing is probably one of the most well-known ways to fish for trout. I know Lawrence and I both enjoy that. I was a guide for almost 10 years. But, you know, there's a lot of different ways you can catch trout, too, that sometimes is a lot easier. And people shouldn't be intimidated by the skill that it does take to fly fish. I think you can take kids out and cast panther martens or, you know, drown a couple worms and also have success as well.
Lawrence Pine, I think, you know, I was thinking about the similarities between fishing and hunting, and a lot of deer hunters will say that part of what they love about hunting is that it reminds them of their dad or their grandfather or their grandmother. There's a traditional nostalgia around hunting, and do you find that there's a similar nostalgia around fishing?
To a certain extent, yes. You know, it's often generational. It's passed down by family, by fathers, by uncles, by brothers, mothers. I think a lot of people do come into fishing, though, from families that didn't necessarily fish. It's a little easier to take up on your own than hunting is. But I would also add that in terms of the appeal of trout fishing, as Pat observed, you know, I think what we love about trout is the places where we find trout. And a big part of the appeal in Vermont is it's so widespread. In almost every town in Vermont, there are opportunities to fish for trout. And a lot of us, as kids, we grew up where our fishing world was where we could walk or bicycle, or as we got a little older, hitchhike maybe. And those were the nearby brooks. And we have a tremendous resource in our small brooks and in our abundant brook trout population. So a big part of it is it's available to us.
The proximity.
The proximity.
Pat Berry, you mentioned the weather and that Saturday, of the few days ahead of us is maybe looking the best, but there is some snow, there's some sleet. It's not all great. Why does fishing season open the second Saturday in April when I think it used to open May 1st? Are we pushing the envelope a little bit there?
Oh, I think a lot of this is tradition, and it gives us a day on which to actually celebrate the opening of trout season. I mean, we've got a number of streams across Vermont that are open for year-round trout fishing. And the reason I don't think all of them are is I think a lot of people appreciate that one single celebratory day. And backing up to Lawrence's point, too, I can tell you one reason that I ended up getting into trout fishing is because when I really started, I was in college and I'd fished my whole life. But, it got to the point with open water fishing where I felt like I needed a boat and a depth finder and a motor, and I was broke. And with trout fishing, all I needed was a pair of waders, which I ended up getting at Vermont Field Sports, back in the 80s for, gosh, I don't know, $40 or something like that. And I figured if I get this, I've got them forever. So it's not only proximity, but it's ease of access as well.
Sure, sure. And for those listening who are not avid trout fishermen and fisherwomen, Lawrence Pine, maybe give a short primer on the difference between fishing with a fly rod and using a spin cast reel and why people might prefer one method over the other.
Well, at Nine, as you noted, there's been books and books written about fishing and books on this subject. Fly fishing is something people do that it's satisfying in and of itself. It's very rhythmic. It's sort of often been described as an art. Sometimes just casting well when you're not catching fish, it's gratifying. It is not inherently difficult. It does take a little bit longer to learn. Spin fishing is a little bit easier for people to learn. Typically, kids will learn to spin fish before they might move on to fly fishing. With spin fishing, also, you have more options in terms of you can fish with bait, you can fish with artificial lures, you can cast farther a little easier. They both have their appeal. I happen to love fly fishing, but I consider myself kind of a Will Rogers of fishing. I love it all. So I certainly spin fish as well.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about fishing and the opening of trout season on Saturday. Vermont Fish and Wildlife Commissioner Pat Barry and Lawrence Pine, host of VPT's Outdoor Journal, are my guests. You can join the conversation, listeners, by calling 1-800-639-2211. Do you have an idea on how conditions will be on your favorite river this weekend? What do you think the state can do to make fishing in Vermont even better? Feel free to join the conversation. Let's take a caller now from Middlebury. Ed, welcome to the program.
Hi. I'm physically not in condition to go walking the stream bank, but I'd like to pass along a way of fishing for large trout early in the season.
Go ahead.
You use a night crawler, very small sinker, and above that use an egg-shaped slip sinker. Cast that to the head of a deep hole, and let the egg sinker roll the bait to the bottom of the deep hole. If you get a strike, don't try to set the hook right away. Big trout like to run with what they've grabbed and then stop and eat it.
Hmm.
Certainly, night crawlers this time of year account for a lot of fish and a lot of big fish, and that's a good tactic.
Ed, thanks for that call. And if you're heading out this weekend, good luck to you. I hope you get one of those big trout. Be very nice. I want to read an email from a Brian who posted on Facebook, and I thought this was a great quote. I'm looking forward to the look of excitement on my son's face as we silently slip our canoe into a glass column pond at dawn and effortlessly glide along the shoreline, only to have the peace and silence shattered by a huge largemouth erupting from the water's surface with his Rapala firmly lodged in his mouth. I hope he gets that.
He might not on Saturday, but, opening day of trout season is very different from other opening days in that, say, walleye season or deer season, it's often the best day of the year. Trout season, the opening of fishing season is about the promise of what's to come, really. And I think that's why we celebrate it, because it kicks off what will be better days. And largemouth bass smashing lures on the surface is part of it.
Although it is certainly true that I think Lawrence is completely right. It is about the promise of what's to come. There are enough really nice fish caught every day opening year that I think that compels people to get out there next year, because they could be one of those people. Even though it's a little tougher, they could be one of those people to get one of those nice opening day fish.
Pepper, let me ask you, how did Tropical Storm Irene impact the state's fish population? And are there still residual effects that folks heading out will notice?
It's a great question. There are going to be residual impacts for years to come. If you think about flooding in and of itself, I mean, these fish and these rivers, they evolved with these natural disturbances. So, you know, a big flood like Irene is simply fast-forwarding the evolution of a river. It rearranges habitat. While it may have washed out a pool, it may have, you know, brought a log jam into place that, you know, and the water pushes into that and creates a hole underneath of it. And it tends to move habitat around. What'll happen with a big flood like that is you'll lose a lot of the young of the year fish in certain reaches of river, but you don't lose the fish in general. And last year, anglers were finding that if they focused on reaches of river that may have been completely arranged by Irene, but were otherwise left alone by people, that they had some tremendous fishing. In the middle ground, there were those areas that had some in-stream work done, either for bridges or road building, where there was an effort to put some habitat back into the river, and those were okay. There were some fish there. They'll come back over time more readily. But reaches a river that were really, and I, you know, again, a lot of this stuff had to be done to bring towns back in connection with the rest of the world, to rebuild bridges. But there were reaches of river that were really rearranged and channelized and dredged and looked very much like aqueducts in the end. And they're not going to hold fish, and those are going to take generations. They're going to take future floods to create that new habitat in years to come. So the best bet, if you're an angler, is just focus on reaches of river that, you know, may have been otherwise rearranged, but you still see habitat. You still see log jams, and there's deep pools, and there's riffles, and there's runs, and there's undercut banks, and there's those overhanging trees. All of those things in place in a good, cold, clear stream will be a sure sign that there's a trout living there somewhere.
Lawrence Pine, you wanted to jump in?
Well, jump in the sense that I think, you know, the commissioner said a lot of that work had to be done. A lot of it was over the top and was opportunistic and going back to an old mentality of hogging out the river, of dredging gravel out of the river. There was a lot of work that was done that was not necessary, and we'll be living with it for a long time to come. I think we're still living with the after effects of the 73 flood. There are sections of the White River upstream of the town of Rochester that are pretty in a Vermont life calendar sort of way, but they have no habitat complexity. I mean, here it is. What is it? We're 40 years after that flood when they hogged it out, when they dredged it out. It's pretty looking water, but it doesn't support much for fish. So we are seeing the trout are incredibly resilient. The young of year class last year was off the charts. So trout did evolve with flooding, and we will see a lot of it bounce back. But in some of the areas where they went in and turned these rivers or sections of rivers into high gradient sluiceways, it's going to be years and maybe not my lifetime before we'll see them come back.
Let's bring in some callers. Let's go to Springfield now and talk with Christopher. Hi, Christopher. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I'm calling to bring up a subject which is quite unpleasant about the after effects of Hurricane Irene. After that storm went through, the State Department of Transportation sent bridge inspectors throughout the state to document damage to bridges. These bridge inspectors were wearing hip boots that had felt-bottomed soles on them. That type of equipment is forbidden to Vermont sportsmen, especially fishermen, to wear in water courses. So these people were going into the streams underneath the bridges to photograph the structures. And so they waded in many, many streams with the same boots in a short proximity of time, and I'm certain, of course I'm a pessimist, that they made no attempt to disinfect those boots from stream course to stream course. And I think it would behoove Commissioner Barry to attempt to track the progression of rock snot algae throughout the state of Vermont after Irene to see if, in fact, our own Department of Transportation basically initiated an epidemic.
All right, I think we've got it. Commissioner Barry, what do you make of the points that he was making about the boots and possibly the rock snot?
Well, it might be helpful. I'll just give a little background here on what the caller was talking about. And I just want to say up front, I really appreciate the concern. In fact, that's one thing, generally speaking, about Vermont hunters and anglers is that they're very passionate about what they do. And we're lucky to have folks who care so much. There is a nasty invasive species called Didymo, otherwise known as rock snot, that can choke out rivers. And a few years ago, the legislature banned the use of felt bottom boots, which had been used for decades and decades to help get a better grip on the bottom of the stream, because it was believed that felt can serve as, a vector or a vehicle to go from one stream to the other. So, this was, Lawrence, you may remember this. I think it was about maybe three or four years ago where that law was passed by the
legislature. I think 2011.
Is that when it was?
2 years ago.
Yep. Oh, there you go. So it's been fairly recent. And I know that agencies like even the Fish and Wildlife Department, we had to go through and upgrade all of our equipment to make sure that we had we did not have felt-soled boots. And there's all kinds of new high-gripping rubber that actually works really well. In fact, I found the ones that I have, I think, on some types of stream bottom work better than felt. So, the goal is to work with the different agencies and departments that, they don't get in the stream that often and probably hadn't gotten to the point of upgrading their equipment. But to the caller's point, too, we do track the spread of Didymo and other invasive species around the state. And we do focus very heavily on trying to educate folks to make that switch over just so that we don't have that problem.
All right. Well, listeners, we are talking about fishing today on Vermont Edition. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-639-22, or you can post a comment or a question online at vpr.net/Vermont Edition.
I see you down in the river, just waiters and a bamboo rod, and it's just before dawn.
Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Kick, in for Jane Lindholm, and we are talking fishing today on the program. My guests are Vermont Fish and Wildlife Commissioner Patrick Barry and Lawrence Pine, outdoor writer for the Burlington Free Press and host of VPT's Outdoor Journal. Feel free to join our conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to Brattleboro now and take a call from Matt. Hi, Matt. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, I've got a very practical reason why my family prefers trout. You can clean them in the house, with the fish that have gills or scales. They make a big mess. And so with trout, they can be frying in the pan 1 minute from the time you bring them in the house. They're so easy to clean.
So easy peasy. Trout's your answer.
They're easy. You just got to get up early enough.
As my mother used to say, you eat everything but the wiggle.
Man, thanks for that call. Let's go on to Warren and take a call from Al. Hi, Al. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi. Welcome to Vermont Edition. What's on your mind?
I'm wondering what the conditions of the trout rivers would be like if we didn't stock them at all.
Oh, interesting question. Commissioner Barry.
It's a great question. We, as a general policy, we do not stock trout where there are otherwise healthy populations. There are some exceptions, which is a longer conversation. But it's really interesting, too. I mean, in some ways, stocking trout may give some folks the idea of a water quality that isn't there. As I mentioned earlier, trout, they're the canary in the coal mine. And and they tell us really a lot about the quality of the river. There are enough places with wild trout in Vermont that, you know, for some people who prefer that sort of thing, that you can certainly find your way and you know, to those wild trout fisheries. But a lot of the reason, you know, there's really two reasons why we stock. One is for restoration efforts in streams, trying to restore populations that may have been affected, let's say, by flooding. Or, you know, we even actually do in-stream projects to try to improve habitat in some cases. And then, you know, we stock afterwards to try to restore them. But, you know, really, it's one of the reasons we stock is also for angler satisfaction on, you know, especially early in the season where folks can take their kids out to reach a river. They'd love to catch a fish or two, have them for dinner. We find that most stocked trout actually don't make it through from year to year, except in those areas where we're really working on restoring fish populations. So the question is, you know, what would it be like if we didn't stock trout? It completely depends from river to river. Some rivers probably wouldn't make too much of a difference. Some would probably be a little bit more challenging. I'd say in most instances, there's still trout there, but maybe not in the same high numbers for just those wild fish.
And how much will Vermont spend to stock its streams, ponds, rivers, and lakes this year?
Well, I mean, we have five fish hatcheries around the state, and we raise a combination of fish. You know, and we don't just raise trout. We also raise lake trout, salmon, walleye, and they're stocked in a number of lakes and ponds. You know, and that's a fairly sizable budget, you know, for all of that. It's about $5 million. What we find, though, and this actually is related to the last caller's question, is that, you know, we generate almost $18 million a year annually from those stocking efforts because of the angler participation in those lakes, ponds, rivers, and where we stock. So it's a very good investment for both recreation and economically as well.
All right. Let me go back to the phone lines now. Let's go to Middlebury and take a call from Jesse. Hi, Jesse. Go ahead.
Hi, Commissioner Barry and Lawrence. It's Jesse Haller. How are you doing today?
We're well, Jesse.
Good.
Good. I just had a question for Mr. Barry and then maybe an opinion for from Lawrence as well. I'm just curious about what Vermont has planned for its future for their fisheries. If we look at some of our neighboring states, we see catch and release sections. We see some fly fishing only stretches. And I was wondering if Vermont has any plans to maybe induct some of our waterways, maybe ones that are a little bit more fragile, into some special regulations. And then my question for Lawrence would be, what do you think? Is that something that would be applicable to our states, in your opinion? So that was what I had.
Commissioner Barry, why don't you start with the first part of that?
Sure. It's worth noting, by the way, that Jesse himself has become known because he caught about an 18 or 20-inch brook trout on a fly a couple weeks ago. And it was spread like wildfire across the digital waves. And if, as Lawrence knows and most anglers listening, that is one heck of a brook trout. So he's pretty accomplished and certainly someone deserving of asking those kinds of questions. Vermont is a very traditional state in a lot of ways, and people get used to having things the way that they've always been for a long time. So if we haven't had a catch and release section or a fly fishing only section, it's hard to really bring about that kind of change. With that said, you know, I'm personally supportive of trying to have more reaches of river like that, because while some folks might say you're taking away other opportunity, when you look at areas where you set aside those reaches, you actually bring a different kind of participation. And you actually can increase participation because it offers a different kind of fishing opportunity, especially with you know, when you implement a catch and release section of river. We just right now are working with the Fish and Wildlife Board. The Fish and Wildlife Board is separate than the department. They set all the regulations. They're an appointed board to try to enhance fishing opportunities across the state, including opening up about 72.5 miles of water for year-round artificial catch-and-release fishing. Also enhances the bass fishing opportunities as well. So this is something that is often on our mind, on my mind, and our fish division works on this as well, of trying to figure out a way to enhance opportunities. But Jesse is, I would agree with Jesse that there's more room to have those kinds of regulations in Vermont.
And Lawrence, did you want to add?
Sure. I mean, Jesse, offer a historical perspective. When I was in college 33 years ago, I was part of the founding of the New Haven River Anglers Association. And one of our goals was to create some special regulation water on the New Haven. we ran into considerable opposition from the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And if you fast forward to today, we're seeing suggestions, regulations coming from the Fish and Wildlife Department, as we saw in Martins and Jobs Pond recently, that protect fisheries, that encourage wild fish, that promote the growth of older fish. There's been a big change in attitude. It's been long and slow in coming, but we are seeing more and more special regulation waters, diverse fishing opportunities. And frankly, part of that is also the trophy trout program the state has, where they're stocking those big two-year-olds. It's a mix of fishing opportunities. It is much more diverse than it was 30 years ago. And I think there's certainly room for us to continue moving forward. But we have seen a big change.
And I got an email from Jeffrey in Heartland. I wanted to share this just because it's so well put. And Jeffrey writes, "I've been an avid fly fisher in Vermont for the past 25 years, and today's program is getting my blood moving." And he adds a wonderful quote: "The allure of fishing is that it is the pursuit of what is elusive but attainable, and offers an endless series of occasions for hope." I like that. Nicholas also emailed in, and he has a question: "Why is the keep limit so high?"
Again, that goes back to tradition. Our regulations have been the same for a long time. And if you look at our neighboring states, Vermont, you can keep 12 trout. You can keep 5 in New Hampshire of a combination of species. And Lawrence, you're probably going to know this better than I can, but Maine's limit, especially for brook trout, is pretty low. But that's actually something that we're also working with the Fish and Wildlife Board on. Brook trout is the most popular fish. I mean, not surprising considering they're one of the most absolutely beautiful fish or critter of any kind, frankly. But the limit is 12. And I think it really sends the wrong message that we don't value our most prized game fish, especially in comparison to our other states. And even with the board looking at it, reducing that brook trout creel limit, you can still keep 12 fish. So it's something, as Lawrence mentioned, the department is looking at, a lot of the different regulations related to trout fishing. This is one that's been around for a long time. I think the last time it was changed was in the 60s or 70s. But Vermont, it really is a place where change does come slow and attitudes are slow to change. I will say that I've heard a lot of really good positive feedback with the board taking a look at changing some of the creel limits, especially for brook trout.
All right, let's go back to the phone lines. Let's take a call from Middlebury. Matthew, hi. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Commissioner and Lawrence. I had actually two questions. One was the question with the underlying desire that Jesse just asked, and I think you did a great job answering that.
And your second? Go ahead.
My other question had to do with whether you think Vermont could have some of the same sorts of sustainable steelhead runs that maybe come out of Lake Michigan or Lake Ontario or even the New York side of Lake Champlain.
Commissioner Barry, do you want to take a crack at that?
Our steelhead fishing in Lake Champlain has actually dramatically improved, and we gauge a lot of the quality of the steelhead not just by creel surveys from anglers, but there's a fish lift at the Winooski One Hydro Project on the Winooski River. And we've already had, even this early in the year, we've already had 27 steelhead go through that fish lift. And every year we're seeing the quality of the fish improve. Excuse me. Now, whether we'll ever get to the point of having the kind of steelhead and salmon fisheries that they have over on the Great Lakes, I doubt it. I mean, we're a very different kind of fishery, but the quality has improved enough that the participation has improved enough that the word's getting out there. And whether you are, out on the main lake trolling for steelhead, or whether you are fishing in some of the tributaries, especially Lewis Creek, people are definitely seeing an improvement in that fishery.
I would absolutely agree. And as I understand it, Commissioner, a couple of years ago, the department switched strains and we're getting better returns on the strain being stocked now. But it's no longer just the Winooski River or even Lewis Creek. I mean, there's steelhead below the falls in Bergens on the Otter Creek, in the La Platte River, up in the Mill River, or Mill Brook in St. Albans. We don't have the same tributaries like the New York side has in terms of, say, Putnam Creek or the Saranac River, but I've seen tremendous growth and improvement in our steelhead fishery. And there were people this winter who were catching steelhead almost every month of the winter.
And I want to make sure we fit in before we wrap up here. I want to get the recommendations for those who are wondering what the best places to fish are. Lawrence, why don't I start with you? Where are the good spots to try to hit this weekend?
Well, certainly the Willoughby River, the Barton Black Willoughby River system is a traditional opening day favorite. The weather this year actually favors anglers up there. Last year we had such a warm, mild March that the steelhead run had largely gone past the falls in Orleans before the season opened. This year I think we'll see good fishing conditions. My recommendation is carry a thermometer. Look for water that's a little bit warmer. A little tributary coming into the stream you're fishing that is maybe 4 or 5 degrees warmer. That is often where you'll find the good fishing, right? Where that little trib comes in. I'm a big believer in using a thermometer this time of year. A few degrees change in temperature can make a big difference.
Commissioner Bear, how about you?
I would agree with Lawrence completely on that front. The flow, the discharge of the water itself and the temperature will dictate whether fish are biting. Sometimes smaller streams might be a better bet in terms of access because they won't be as high, but they'll probably be a little bit colder. Lawrence mentioned some steelhead rivers up in the Northeast Kingdom. I think you'd also have good luck looking for steelhead in the rivers we previously mentioned that are tributaries to Lake Champlain. But as far as the where to go also, I mean, I think there are a lot of great river systems. I think the White River system is often undervalued and underappreciated. I think a lot of the tributaries that come out of both sides of the Green Mountain National Forest up and down the state are often undervalued. And I would say if you're not sure about trout fishing, you're not really sure what to even use, local knowledge is so important. And I would encourage folks, go to your local fishing and hunting store and ask the guys there. Let them know, look, I want to go fishing. I don't know what to use. I don't know where to go. And, 95% of the time, they're gonna help you out. I think that's the biggest hurdle for people getting out there. They're not really sure what to do. And we also have really good information on our website for both when we'll do the stocking on certain rivers. We've got information on, what to use and where to go. But it's those local shops that can really help you out.
All right. Well, on that note, I'll have to wrap things up, and I wish you both great fishing this weekend. Pat Barry is Vermont's Fish and Wildlife Commissioner, and Lawrence Pine is host of Vermont Public Television's Outdoor Journal, which begins its 11th season on Tuesday. Gentlemen, thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you.
Thanks for doing the show.
Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck. If you've ever found poetry in the lines of a good novel, you'll appreciate Pulitzer Remix, sponsored by the Found Poetry Review to celebrate National Poetry Month. It features 85 artists making poetry from all 85 Pulitzer Prize-winning works of fiction. The poets come from all over the world, and one of them, James Moore, is a playwright who lives in Winooski. He joined VPR's Jane Lindholm to explain the project.
James Moore, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks for having me.
I'm not actually familiar with the book that you are creating poetry from, Scarlet Sister Mary. It's by Julia Peterkin, and it was the Pulitzer Prize winner in 1929. Can you tell us a little bit about what the book is about?
Yeah, I actually was not familiar with it either. It was one of the remaining books when I signed on to the project, and it was new to me and fairly not difficult to find, but it wasn't, on the corner bookshop's shelf. It's a story of a community of Gullah people living on a plantation near the turn of the century or in the early 20s. And it's written by a white woman, but it's solely from the black community's point of view, and there isn't a white person in sight. It's a very interesting, thorny look at this woman, Mary, and her desire to live her life and claim her femininity and sexuality to the fullest in this community that does not look so fondly on that.
So you said that it was one of the few books that was left over. Did you come late to the project?
Everybody could select 3 or 5 books that you would be most interested in editing. And of course, the books that I picked were probably the books that other people picked too, by Faulkner or The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay and the big hitters. So I didn't get my first round pick, but nothing against Scarlet Sister Mary because I'm glad I got her.
Did you read the book first for content, or were you reading it, since it sounds like this was the first time you'd picked up the book, were you reading it with an eye to what kind of poetry you could create?
I had started off thinking that I would not read it, that I would just pick pages. I decided that I'd have my friends on Facebook pick which pages I would work with and have a poem for each page that the 30 people picked. And so originally I wasn't going to read it at all. But then as I was thinking more about it, I didn't want my poems to be what the book was about. I didn't want it to be like, I'm creating a new version of Scarlet Sister Mary. I wanted my poems to exist based on the language, but create a whole different either story or moment or reflection than was in there. And I thought the best way to do that would be to read the book in full, so I would make sure I stayed away from that.
So you're not trying to work thematically with the book?
No, I learned early on, one of the first poems that I did was based on Scarlet Sister Mary's first page, which to contemporary eyes may seem a little hard to swallow. It talks about the good black people versus the bad or low black people. And the language is just really, it's disconcerting to my eye anyway. And so when I first did my poem based on that page, I felt like it was more a commentary on the text and the times than it was its own piece. So I backed up and I started again, and I realized it was better for me to create a whole new work. Also, on a purely copyright note, there's nothing that says that I own Scarlet Sister Mary. So for me to create a new version of that didn't feel appropriate to me, or what found poetry is supposed to be.
What are the actual rules? I mean, you're creating poetry from the words on the page, not your own words, but are you allowed to use any of your own words? Can you pick and choose from different pages?
We can pick and choose from different pages. Some people scan through the whole book, or they read the whole book and they select phrases or themes that they want to get back to, and then they piece together a poem based on that. Some people, like myself and like David Kraliski, the other Vermont poet, are constricting ourselves to one page, and we mostly keep the words in order. But the basic rule is that we're using the words that exist there, and we can either re-scramble or reshape or do whatever we want within those confines.
Would you read us one of your poems?
Sure, sure. So yeah, I'll read this poem, which I cleverly titled 82 for two reasons. One, it's the page that was selected was page 82, and also it was the year that my grandmother passed away. She was 82 when she passed away. Always answered blackness, blossoms, breath, but charm came deeper. Delicate essence, eyes flash from her, here. I just knew, like lemon, like lightning makes mouth new, not of perfumes, rather rain scent. She smiled, strange summer sweat, sweet the time, to walk was whole you.
Hmm. When you knew you were going to have to write a poem from page 82, were you trying to figure out how you could make it fit with your grandmother? Were you reading the words and then trying to think, what can I create? I mean, what was your process like for that poem?
In that instance, actually, my mom actually pointed out, because she was trying to select a page number and she wanted page 82, and I was like, somebody already got it. And then she told me why, and I was like, oh yeah, that's great. So I wanted to shape it around her in some ways, but the words on the page in order didn't make that possible for me. So I actually took all of the words and I alphabetized them, and then I looked for phrases that the alphabetizing came up with. And I just pulled ones out that seemed most like her. And most of the poems still exist in alphabetical order. There's one cheat in there.
So the way you've been publishing them is that you sort of show the pages of the book as well. And there's a little bit of a scrapbook feel, or, you know, kind of a design and an artistic feel, because you can see how you got the words on the page and then created a poem, whereas some of the other poets in this group aren't doing that. So you don't really have a sense of where in the book this came from. Why did you want to keep some sense of the page and some sense of order and disorder? You know, you have in some of them, you have scribble marks or, you know, circles around the words and then connections to them. So it's very much visible as well as a poem.
Someone pointed out we had a Facebook private group before this project started, and it's still going now, of the poets, where we could share our work and get feedback from people. And one of my first attempts was really messy, and they said that it was hard to read. This poet, Winston Plowes, I hope I'm saying his last name right, but he said that it was hard to read, and I said, yeah, I need to learn how to draw straighter lines through my lines. And he said, no, I like the handmade feel of it. And that really struck me. So part of it is about handmade, and part of it is just for me to acknowledge the work that Julia Peterkin did. These are not my words, and so I like showing that and being like, here's the page, here's where it came from. They're all based on a single page, or in some cases two pages. I can show those images really easily, whereas some people are pulling from a whole chapter or from a whole book, and it's much harder to scan, you know, a line from each of the 30 pages or however many they ended up pulling from.
It almost seems like cheating, though, if you can use the whole book. I mean, aren't you going to find almost any word you could possibly want somewhere in a novel and be able to just create your own words?
There are people being really, really strict with that, in that they will really search to make sure that that word really is in there, because there is a certain sense of, like, surely the word people is in my book somewhere. But I think different people find freedom in different things. And for me, the restriction of one page is really freeing and opens up new possibilities that I wouldn't otherwise look for. And I think some other people want that whole book so they can. If a poem is just this close to working, if they can find that word on page 32, then it's like, great, that's perfect, you know? So I think it's a different strokes, different folks kind of thing.
You mentioned that there's a Facebook page with the other poets. Have you connected with some of these poets from around the country and other countries?
Yeah, I was going to say, and around the world, yeah, I've actually exchanged some messages with a couple of poets from the UK and from Africa, and it's been a really great group to get to know, and really fun to see the different methods that people are playing with and experimenting with, and it was a really nice sounding board.
What do you hope people get out of this project all put together, I mean, with all 85 of you?
I hope that people see the variety of possibilities that can be made from found poetry and just the types of poetry. I know some people are doing tankas and some people are doing haikus and some people are doing poetry like we're doing. And I just think the range of what you can make is very interesting. I also think, and something I wouldn't have thought of when I first got onto this project, was I kind of want to encourage people to look up some of these books. Like, Scarlet Sister Mary is not one that I would have read otherwise, and I'm so glad that I did. Her poetry in the pages themselves that I'm destroying and ripping up is beautiful, and I really hope that some people see those words on some of those pages and think, I've really got to read that book, you know, the original book. And I hope it opens people up to these 85 poets. I hadn't heard of 83 of these poets, so myself and David I'd heard of. But it's been really nice to see their work, and it makes me want to seek out the rest of their work as well.
James, thanks very much for telling us about the project and sharing your poetry with us.
Thanks so much, Dana. I appreciate it.
James Moore is a poet and playwright living in Winooski. We have a link to the Pulitzer Remix Project, where he and 84 others are turning the words of Pulitzer Prize-winning novels into poetry every day in April. You'll find it at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Finally, today, we continue our series marking the 20th anniversary of the Vermont Folklife Center's Traditional Arts Apprenticeship Program. We heard earlier this week from stonecutter Heather Milne Ritchie, who was an apprentice in the program. Today, we hear from the master stonecutter who taught Heather and others and has helped keep their art alive in the granite sheds of Barrie.
I'm George Krajanowicz. The stock in trade in my studio is religious relief carvings on gravestones. And I started doing apprenticeships in granite through the Vermont Folklife Center in 1998. I've done a total of five. It has delighted me to no end to see individuals still willing to try their hand at what is really a very difficult trade/art. I think that at least two or three of the apprentices that I have trained are still actively involved, either in my studio or in other studios here in Barrie. There are, at any given time, between 10 and 12 sculptors active in the granite industry. The apprenticeships are long. They take 3 months. They are very intensive. You have to physically exert yourself. Granite is very hard. You have to bang on it. Things start to hurt. You stand up, you do this standing up, your legs hurt, your back hurts, your arms hurt, your fingers hurt, your wrists hurt, and you get used to it, and you have to be able to overcome that discomfort and concentrate on the task at hand. And it takes a special individual.
Yeah.
You can see photos of George Gurjanowicz at work at VPR.net. We'll conclude our series tomorrow with a Congolese Vermonter who teaches young people the dancing and drumming of his native land. And there'll be a reunion of alumni of the Folklife Center's Arts Apprenticeship Program Saturday in Burlington. And that's it for today. Tomorrow, Bob Kinzel will be hosting, and he'll be talking about marijuana decriminalization. Bob's here to tell us about it.
Nina, the Vermont House is set to vote on this bill tomorrow. We'll look at why some lawmakers are strongly supporting the legislation and why some law enforcement officials strongly oppose it.
And you can send your questions or comments about that show to Vermont Edition at vpr.net. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson and Jennifer Brandt. Peter Biello directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Nina Keck. Thanks for listening.